This is the second sign.
Reverence for the great power that is in numbers. They are brazen enough to say, if I can number a thing, so what? Anybody who deals with this Pythagorean paper should think twice before he delivers it to me, because I will not accept any impertinence or brazenness or insolence. It's a very solemn thing to hear the harmony of the spheres. And those who deals with Pythagoras? There's only one? And he... Yeah. You do well to read in a translation, of course, this is a very brief thing, at least the Timaeus by Plato once through. It's a short thing to read. But there you find the response to Pythagoreanism by a mind like Plato. He wasn't a Pythagorean, but in his old age, he heard also the harmony of the spheres, and as a matter of fact, the greatest expression of the Pythagorean secret is today for us in the Timaeus, a dialogue of the latest years of Plato. With regard to Aristotle, the opposite is true. There is so much we have about from Aristotle's pen that I have never thought that you could read everything, and that would be even useful to recommend an extended reading. I would suggest that you take up two books in full, either Politics and Poetics, or The Constitution of Athens and the Nicomachean Ethics, or the Book on Politics, but there have to be at least two full-fledged books which you analyze in your paper to get to the method. You can also get his books on animals and plants, because he created, as the first man in history, the power to describe something objectively. And so it's a question of your own selection. And I don't want to make any prescribe anything, because Aristotle is really of an amazing universality. And if I would cut out a certain book, I would prejudice your own taste. Anybody who's interested in the natural sciences will go to his natural scientific writings. They are, as with regard to style and representation, I think just as exciting as the political writings or the literary writings. I don't think there is, in my mind, any one writing by Aristotle in which his greatness is greater, so to speak, than in the others. If you always keep in mind that with Aristotle we reach this moment of quiet contemplation of the width of the universe, of the famous Greek pan, including men, including the variety of states. Also, if one of you writes a paper, who is dealing with Aristotle? What all of you want to do is to meditate on this tremendous undertaking of his, that he had 158 constitutions of different states worked over and represented objectively, not swallowing them all up in a neat system of politics as we write our textbooks on government today, but expounding carefully the workings of 158 different systems so that everyone would could be done justice and could stand out in its own light, so to speak, and on its own merits. We have only one of these books today, but the principle of his assortment, of his selection, of his undertaking deserves your clear statement in your paper, because in addition to the you may say, notes his students got from his lectures, which we now today call his books, these many of his real writings, which he wrote himself, dialogues and others, are lost. And it's very unfair today to compare Aristotle, the Aristotelian bulk of literature, with the Platonic, because the proper doctrine of Plato was never written. And these dialogues are sideline books. And he says so himself in his seventh letter. Who's dealing with Plato? So just to finish my word on Aristotle, so be careful not to be dismayed, so to speak, by the lack of beauty in Aristotle's books. Most of it has been preserved by notes, you see, taken down by his students. What is it?
How should we fit the advice between the Aristotle?
Well, as much as you can. He is the real son of Aristotle. And he adds to Aristotle the dealing with characters, with human types, you see. So he tries to go on from the animals and plants and even follow this into human nature. And his characters to this day are outstanding descriptions of temperament, you see. I think I must leave this to you, just as I leave the selection of the writings of Aristotle to you. I think in Theophrastus it becomes clear what the ultimate, so to speak, is, the highest. Most gentlemen, most great men reach their achievement in their best student, in their best pupil. You see, you cannot understand Christ without Paul. It has been the fashion in the last 100 years to say that Paul spoiled Christianity, but he didn't. He made it understandable, and he has saved it. And nobody understands Christ who doesn't understand Paul. And this habit of killing Paul in order allegedly to love Christ is a very bad habit. And I think it's wearing off today. It has been done with a great ruthlessness and great lack of taste. So with Theophrastus and Aristotle, it's a little similar, you see. He's his best pupil. And the real man, you see, the man who got it all from Aristotle, you see, and where it stands out very clearly. With regard to Plato, every one of you has to deal with the seventh letter. The seventh letter is his own statement about the relation of his writings to his teachings. If you don't read the seventh letter, then you do not understand the place which he gives himself to his literature. And you are also paper-minded and paper-bound-minded that you think when a man writes a book, that's a man. Far from it, gentlemen, you see. You don't know Plato if you don't see his life. His achievement is the great 80 years which he lived from 480. What are his dates? Who knows the life days of Plato? Well, then I have to assume that you haven't even started on your paper on Plato. That's the first thing, after all. When a man writes about another man, he goes and looks up his dates and learns them by heart. Otherwise, you can't know anything about the man. Any idea? Do you know when you have been born? Well, without it, you are lost. If you don't know whether you are 15 or 28, you don't know how to behave. This is not ridiculous, gentlemen. I assure you that as long as you haven't put down the dates of Plato and made clear that he was 28 years old when Socrates died in his absence, to his great dismay, and that is the real tragedy of Plato's life, as I told you, then you don't understand Plato, how he spent the rest of 42 more years of immortalizing Socrates. That's a very strange relation. 28 is 4 times 7. These are 4 phases of growth, and there were then left to him how many more years? 42 years. Is that right? That's 6 times 7. And you can see that his life consists of at least 6 stations after the death of Socrates. And these stations are very important because he changes constantly and finds new ways of doing what the death of Socrates obliges him to do. He's under the spell of this event for the rest of his life. So the dates 428 to 348 are of utmost importance. They are also of such importance because you must take down the date when Aristotle was born. When was he born? Does nobody know that?
427.
See?
What? 427.
That's Plato. And Aristotle?
385.
What?
385.
Are you sure?
385 and
384. Yeah, I think it's 384. Well, that's very important because the academy is founded in 387. So you must think that Aristotle is born into a going concern. And that he is such a classic is that he hadn't to pay the penalty, hadn't given his blood for the blood bank of founding the academy. That's a great difference, gentlemen. If you are a founder, you have to waste your time to make people see what should be done. If you are born into something, you see, you can proceed to do it. You see the difference? And therefore, that's a real break between Plato and Aristotle, gentlemen, that Plato's whole life is consumed in making to the Greeks this point clear that there should be a center of free studies, not subservient to any one city. That's the academy. And we have led up to this all this time. I've tried to explain to you that although Plato is an Athenian and although he is founding a school in Athens, the school is not of Athens, but is the heiress, the heritage of the achievement of all of Greece, like the Trojan War. Just as all Greeks waged the war and came to common consciousness in Homer, you see, so a second time the academy brings together all the achievements from all the cities of Greece, including the colonies in the Far East, in Africa, and in the Far West, in Africa, in Cyrene, in Italy, in Sicily, you see. And it's a homecoming of all these, you see, stormy petrels. And that's a great, you know, isn't it? It's much different from what you learn. Plato founded the academy in Athens. If I had let you believe this, you see, you wouldn't understand what's the importance. Any podunk in America today can found an academy. And if you just take the words academy and city, you have no idea what Greek philosophy is about. Now with Aristotle, then the dates are again terribly important. And when he dies, the whole Western Mediterranean, gentlemen, is no longer governed in cities, but by kings, in big states. Alexander has come, has smashed up all these hundreds of cities, and he has been the new Achilles. And whereas in the Trojan War, Achilles dies and the Greeks return home, you can say that in the Alexandrian Empire, the cities, with all their named heroes, you see, die, lose their independence, and what is remaining is the Hellenistic one world of the Mediterranean, to be inherited later by the Romans, as you know it. What you call classical civilization is the gift of Alexander and the Romans to us. So, gentlemen, perhaps you see now the tremendous way in all your papers. You will have to be aware that who is dealing with the Stoics. The Stoics only come into their own after that, Epicurus too, when the world has already become one, you see, when nobody can hope to live in one city because you already live in tremendous territories. Alexander has come and learned too well from Aristotle, you see, what to do. Alexander, as you know, the pupil of Aristotle, and you cannot say the student, because he certainly did not carry out Aristotle's dreams or visions. He is not a disciple of Aristotle. He is not an Aristotelian. He's a young god who shows the relativity of this academic and peripatetic knowledge by doing the very opposite. So the greatness of this century, of the fourth century, gentlemen, is then in these very days. Socrates is born when? Is it 348?
I thought he died in 348, isn't that right?
And Aristotle died when? Now, here is the reign of
Alexander. Here is the famous Peloponnesian War. Here before goes the tremendous battles of liberation of the Greeks for freedom against the Persians, which are the two great battles. Quiet. So from the outside, Greece is seen for another 150 years. But then from the north, from their own Prussian north, from Macedonia, which is very much like the Prussians in Germany, comes the unifying force. Alexander overrides all these hundreds of cities, unifies them, and the payoff is that he makes all the other realms around the Mediterranean Greek. After, this is the battle against the older civilizations here. Persians, and of course that includes Babylon and Egypt, all the pre-Greek empires you see are smashed or are stopped here. Then Alexander comes, as you know, marches into Persia, defeats the great king of Persia, and what remains after 323 in the Mediterranean world down to Babylon and down to Assur is Greek. So he replaces the pre-Greek empires with a Greek empire, Greek-speaking empires. There are kingdoms subdivided under, but they all speak Greek. When the Romans come, it's like a natural rehabilitation of the Alexandrian dream. Alexander the Great carries as a pupil of Aristotle the Greek thought of the Academy, of the Stoics, of the Epicureans, of all the schools of Greek thought, also into non-Greek, you see the non-Greek word. And we have it for this reason today. You may say that vaccine has to be vaccinated first on a little culture, and then it can be sent to all the school children you see in America. In the same way, gentlemen, in antiquity, Greek thought was vaccinated in a test case on the whole Mediterranean. And today, if you go to the United Nations, that's very Greek, indeed. And our Olympic Games in Melbourne and our United Nations in New York are the Greek aspect of the world. It isn't the whole aspect of the world. You can't live by the United Nations alone, and you can't live by the Olympic Games alone, but it's an essential part of our existence. And it has all been exercised or trained into us for first time 2,000 years ago. And that's why the games in Melbourne are called the Olympic Games, you see. And that's why the term which is used in the United Nations incessantly is politics. That's the Greek word polis. We have not taken over the word empire. We have not taken over the word theocracy from the Egyptians or the Babylonians, you see. We speak of politics. That's Greek. And if you could see these dates, gentlemen, in their true light, you should learn them, gentlemen, well, as you learn skiing, or as you learn any practical thing. These figures are full of significance, because it shows you how much long it takes to develop a new serum, a new vaccine, to immunize any one city of men, you see, against seclusion, to open it up, and to put it into connection, you see, with a mental process, you see, that is bigger than McCarthy in Wisconsin. Socrates dies from the hand of Mr. McCarthy in 399. The accusation is that the gods of Athens do not suffice for him. And I think the accusation was true. And I think under the laws of Athens, he was justifiably condemned. And this is for you a hard lesson, gentlemen, but the story of Greek philosophy is that the intrusion of a new dimension of thinking, this universal dimension that you think for the whole world,
has to be bought at a price. What you do not understand, gentlemen, is that in a tragedy, both sides can be right. And in the death of Socrates, to which I now wish to turn today, especially, the main problem is, and is acknowledged by Socrates in his Criton, and we spoke about this before, you see, is that progress in humanity does not come about in the simple and silly way that one man is wrong, your parents are wrong and you are right, or you are wrong and their parents are right, gentlemen, but your parents are right and you are right. And then life becomes interesting. They defend something important and you defend something important, you see. And at one moment it isn't yet decided how the two can live together. And therefore, both sides are right. And both sides, you see, are too narrow. They haven't yet found a way in giving room for this other life. So the Athenians, from their point of view, I think, can be called blind men, just as the Jews when they crucified the Lord, narrow men, deaf men, but they were not in the sense unjust according to their own law. The law has to be fulfilled even if it hasn't yet been abolished. You can only conclude from 399 that the Athenians now had to open up a place in their suburb, called later the Academy, in which a Socrates, you see, could exist without being accused by the citizens of Athens of heresy and of defying the Athenian gods, because he was trying to make the Athenian gods rhyme and square with God in the universe. So the main point I wish to make about Socrates is, gentlemen, today, that he was the tragic figure in which the new element of universal thought, of a thought of second impressions, of critical thought, came to blows with the world of first impressions. To you who live in such a loose world of only second impressions, who live by abstraction, your head is full of abstractions like philosophy and politics, and that's all abstract. And you are full of theology. If you analyze the vocabulary of an American senior in college, out of 9 words which you use, 8 are abstracts, and 1 is concrete. And you don't even know what an abstract is. Most of you think that the abstract is concrete and the concrete is abstract. You know how to define concrete? What's the difference between abstract and concrete? Pardon me?
One's a tangible concept while the other is more of an ideological idea rather than an actual object.
Well, I would go so far to say that full concrete, you see, you are not a concept. You're concrete, you see. So the complete concrete, you see, cannot be covered or explained by a concept, you see. A concept always takes some generalization, you see. You can only conceive of something if you abstract from its specific, you see, things and put it into some class. You have to classify it. And already, when I begin to classify you, I do you wrong, you see. You're quite unique, sir. You are a human being, but I haven't said very much if I say you are a human being, you see. And your wife can't do anything with a human being. She can only do something with you. I mean, we marry one, you see, person. So a person is concrete, you see, and is not abstract. And persons, of course, are the holy resistors against abstractions, and I try to show you that in Greek philosophy the saving grace has always been the philosopher. He is the one concrete miracle, you see, which remains undissolved, the Pythagoras himself, Plato, Socrates, you see. Unshaken, he is a person. And you remember that I try to show you that there are 3 miracles and not one. Instead of one. You think, yes, I wish to, can be, intellect your curiosity, I may be surprised why the earth turns around the sun. That's only the objective miracle, as to fact, you see. But the person who can discover this, that this is a miracle, is miraculous, more miraculous. The big brain of Mr. Einstein is miraculous, you see, much more miraculous than all the laws of relativity. I had to deal in my sociology, which has just appeared, with the problem of the Freudians, for example. And I say that there should be in every generation a man like Sigmund Freud, or that like Karl Marx, or like Plato, is much more important than the doctrine of Freudianism, because it is more important that in every generation a new doctrine can be proclaimed. You must see this. If you say psychoanalysis is everything, the result might be that there might be no great men, because we think of every great man later than just as a lunatic who has an Oedipus complex. You see? And if you declare every great man in the future as a man who comes out of inhibition, repression, Oedipus complex, inferiority complex, superiority complex, you see, etc., then out goes greatness, out goes innovation, because you have then analysts who put these people into straitjackets. That's all that happens to the great men then. So the person of Freud is much more important from my point of view of life in the community and the future of this country. That there should be in the next generation freedom again for a man to teach, I don't know what, I don't know it, but I must make room for his appearance. Can you see this? Same with Marx. You see it now with the trouble they have in Russia, you see, by having deified one doctrine, you see. They can't go on. You see, they are absolutely hamstrung at this moment and dead end street, because they have declared that the doctrine developed in 1847 is the ultimate doctrine, which is utter nonsense, obviously. You see? And that's the nonsense about Bolshevism. Not what they teach, but that they teach that this is ultimate doctrine. So, gentlemen, you can only cure yourself from this if you see that the Greeks in Socrates, in Plato, in Aristotle, in Pythagoras, in Thales, in all these sages, have names to conjure with to save themselves from the mere admiration of the objective statements of these men. Can you see this? So, to admire the philosopher, gentlemen, is the corollary to admiring the philosophy. If you do not admire the philosopher, the creative spirit who has brought up the philosophy, you will admire a makeshift, a man-made mannequin, a philosophy, whereas you have to admire the tremendous brain that is able to develop such a philosophy, you see. And these we need at all times. This is the real problem of freedom. Gentlemen, we owe our freedom as general citizens of the world, as millions, only to the deep conviction of any civilized group that they have to make room for genius. It's genius that saves you and me from being herded to the polls in a one-party system. Because in democracy, we say we don't know the next leader, you see. We must give the minority a chance to become the majority. Now that's exactly the same story as Mr. Freud's life story, who was for 30 years rejected by everybody, you see. And now in this country, you run amok with him. But that will wear off, of course, and there must be room for somebody else who contradicts Mr. Freud or has something else important to say. I don't know what. So the third miracle, gentlemen, then, is the currency which greatness and genius is given in a community that hates it at first. That the ethics of the proper process of teaching, of knowledge, of education, you see, that we have to learn that Socrates executed for high treason and blasphemy at 399, in 387 can become the god of the academy or the good spirit of the academy in the suburbs of Athens, and that people, although they have strangled his physical existence, bow to the evidence, are overcome, you see, by a new ethics, and therefore the logos of Socrates become the ethics of the Greeks, you see, on the physics of the universe. You remember my constant repetition of these three items? And therefore, there are three miracles in the world, gentlemen. The logical miracle that there are great minds, in seeming contradiction, in every generation, renewing the life of our race. The ethical miracle that although at first they are sound impossible and madmen, we finally bow and make room for the current which they create, for the stream of life which they impart. And third, that the universe looks different when we
bow ethically to the logical power of these spirits. You will find it again and again that without this careful division of the logical and the ethical and the physical, you have no philosophy. Today, men in modern society has no philosophy because he treats genius also as physical and God also as a fact. God is not a fact, gentlemen. It's the power that makes you say something new. That's something quite different. That's the best I can tell you about. What we know of God, the first thing we know is that you can make a declaration of love today where you haven't made one yesterday. That's such a tremendous fact in your life that you know that God is the power who allows you this freedom. Yesterday you said, I'll never marry a girl from Cleveland, it's a terrible city. Tomorrow you go and propose to her. You are overcome by a new power, a new affection. I mean, that's a joke, you understand, but you might have said that you will never marry a Jewish, or you will never marry a Muslim girl, or a Negro girl, you see. And tomorrow you go and you are overcome, you see, by the new truth that you have to do just the very thing you have defied before, you see, you'll never do. This is the new logos. This is the logos in action. That's not what you call logic, of course. And I warn you, what Americans call philosophy and ethics and logic has nothing to do with Greek philosophy. What you call ethical is what your Aunt Elizabeth thinks is ethical. That's not ethics. And what you call is logical is what an accountant can do in arithmetic. Of course, arithmetic is very good, but it has nothing to do with philosophy, gentlemen. Philosophy is the discovery that in every one moment new truth is breaking in. And that you may be the vessel of this new truth. God speaks through you every minute, unexpectedly, against your will. Most people, gentlemen, who have proclaimed the new truth have been very reluctant to do it. The people who are very eager to proclaim something usually don't proclaim truth. Walter Winchell doesn't proclaim truth. He's very eager to proclaim something every day over the radio, you see, but just isn't truth. Don't tell him, otherwise he'll attack me too. Well, such a scoundrel, what have you? I mean, there's no truth in this. There's no logos. That's sadism. That's black joy. The misfortunes of other people. So this is and remains then the key to your treatment also of your term papers, gentlemen. You must always see that the coming in of this philosophy at a certain time as a power integrated into the life stream of all our thought ever since is the problem to be respected. It isn't can be brushed aside as, oh, Jesus says this, so what? You have to say, imagine, one day a man discovered the sanctity of numbers, the quality of numbers. And at this point, I'm now back to Pythagoras. And we ended the last time, as you remember, with the tetractus. And what is remaining in Plato, in the Timaeus, and in Aristotle, out of the Pythagorean thought, is something that we have to reconquer today. The quality of numbers. The quality of numbers. You only know that numbers are quantities. You think that four, you remember we talked about this before, are only 1, 2, 3, 4, and then you go on 5, 6, 7. But, gentlemen, a century, even, has a quality of its own. A century is not 100 years, or 3,600,524 days, according to the astronomical calendar. But you and I are members of a century that overpowers you and me, because we belong to a certain century, you see. We can't think all differently. When this century ends, it will dismiss our posterity from this same hypnosis. But we poor people are the 20th century. So we are obviously, if you don't discover the power of the quality which a century has over us, you see, by some truer worship of truer gods and the spirit of the times, we are just contemporaries. Most of you, as you know at this moment, deny
that numbers have any spell or get you all boast that you are class of 57 or class of 56, or class of 58, class of 59. The greatest example of this was given in 1940 in this college. A friend or here, a colleague of mine, Professor Bartlett, gave a paper to write on St. Augustine to a student, and he got the amazing reply, "Here I am, a senior in Dartmouth College in the year of the Lord 1940. I think that my predecessors in this college, who went to war in 1917, were pretty stupid. They were taken in by warmongers. And I feel very superior to these people who went before me by 23 years. How can I be asked now to write on a man who died in 430 AD? That was his logic. That's a typical, you see, contemporary, boasting, you see, of the spirit of his own day and not seeing the quality, the limitation of only being a spirit of his own day and being unable to understand the importance of a man who lived 1500 years before him. The total impotency. And I think it has hit most people today. They are impotent to listen to any truth that has nothing to do with the spirit of the times. You're quite sure that you know everything you have to know from reading the newspapers. But they stifle your sensibilities, gentlemen. They make you deaf. They do exactly what the Bible says. They have ears and they don't hear, and they have eyes and they don't see. That's the business of the newspapers. They make such a noise, you see, and they have so many pictures that you cannot see a little more on the long wavelengths, you see, of all the times. Therefore, I go back to something simpler, gentlemen. I try to tell you that the so-called tetractus of the Pythagoreans meant that in when you deal with anything in the world, you must never be satisfied by reducing it to two or three, like capital and labor. I've written a whole book about the formative of man to say that if you do not take in the mad salesman and the engineer, the inventor, into the business of industry, you never understand industry. Industry is not management and labor, you see. It's sales as well as invention, innovation, technological change, you see, which is neither labor nor management, obviously, that goes in another potato field. And there again, I have made the, who knows the multiplometer? Some of you, Mr. President. Well, just another attempt to be a Pythagorean, that is not to deal with anything worldly, with fewer instances than at least four. Only when I take four different points, am I sure that I am not forcing the issue by my little logic here up here, you see, by my the play of my mind. The outer world, gentlemen, is not logical, but has to be experienced in its vastness, and four is the protection. Now, in Greek philosophy, this played a tremendous part practically then with Plato, with Aristotle, because of the four cardinal virtues. Already in the 5th century, before Plato, before Socrates, it was recognized that you cannot describe a man's virtues by saying he's virtuous. That would be empty, you see, or he's good. As soon, however, as you try to analyze, you found at least four qualities, which may not be sufficient, but at least four. And you know which they were. Everybody knows the four cardinal virtues, don't you? Of the great chief. Please.
Temperance, justice, courage, and prudence.
Let's put them here. They can, of course, be expressed in different terms.
Courage and what's the necessity?
Now, you can say justice is the distribution of prudence, temperance, and courage. That is, you can put
Putin's addresses if you like to in the center and have the three, you see, go out like rays, or you could put them in the square. The important thing is, don't try to reduce what to get. Don't try to say that you can say courage is temperance and prudence is justice. As soon as you do resist this temptation of all the little logicians to have lesser and fewer things, and reduce everything to this big monism, number one, everything is water, everything is this, then you are a Pythagorean. Because you have given the number four the quality to deal with reality. Will you take this down, gentlemen? The number four has this great merit that it forces you to stay within empirical experience and not to get out of it with neat logical tricks. You can, of course, argue by argument, everything has been proved, you see. I can prove that you don't exist. And you can prove that I don't exist. But then I slap you in the face and you suddenly empirically realize that I do exist. The whole argument hasn't proven anything. And therefore, gentlemen, don't take this lightly. Through the whole of Greek philosophy, we have inherited to this day this assumption that there are three virtues. Prudence, temperance, courage, and justice. The argument has only been what they are, how they relate to each other, how you should deal with them, you see, when you should be courageous, then you should be prudent, how you can combine them, etc. The great achievement of the Greek mind has been to let them stand. And if you think back to Thales, whose first power was to reduce, to unify, to generalize, to say there is a common denominator, water, in 582. You see suddenly that the answer now is don't reduce too much. There are certain source qualities, genuine primary elements which must never be reduced. And therefore, if you read now up on Pythagoras and on the numbers, the theory of numbers, you must understand that there is something that has nothing to do with mathematics, but with your best logic. I warn you to try to develop a system in which the flourishing, luscious universe is ever brought under too few articles of faith. As you know, there are, on the other hand, in dealing with the gods, the three supernatural virtues, there is hope and faith and love. And there's a deep reason why God can be explained by three terms. All what we call the world, gentlemen, contains death, contains corruption. And the world, therefore, has always the elements of force. What we call, when we are forced to speak of forces that rule this world, create this world, restore this world, regenerate this world, judge this world, three is enough, because death is not contained in our description of the Trinity. So I won't have promised you last time to show you that the numbers 4 and 3 and 7 are not arbitrary at all. They are not to be gotten by your little brain by numbering 1, 2, 3, 7, 4, 5, 6, 7. They are only gotten by coming down from the infinite. From the infinite of your own spirit, of your wonder, sense of wonder, and trying to peg numbers on your experiences. And the minimum peg you have to hang on to the world outside of your senses is 4. If you don't, you go and go become a lunatic in a lunatic asylum. Most lunatics with megalomania ideas have systems of thought that have given up this empirical respect for reality and talk just of one or two principles. In the whole 19th century, you had this bias of the so-called movement. God is just expressive of the brain. Everything is just so perfect, and everything is energy, or everything is atom, or everything is wave, or everything is electricity. These are very stupid people. But they had a tremendous following in the 19th century because people had given up the spirit of observing their own existence. In as far as you can say something that is true to them, in hope and in faith, out of faith and in love to your, the person you want to convince to save by your saving word. So isn't it? The divine that doesn't take up space, that doesn't corrupt like the living word, can be enter your experience in this form of three. I can't go into the whole theology of this, but I only warn you, don't poke fun at the Pythagoreans and don't poke fun at the Trinity. As long as you poke fun at it, you don't know even the problem that has given rise to these four statements. These four statements come from a real experience, and your statements come from a silly reflect a reaction of a schoolboy who learns figures in a recipe. That's not it. That's not experience, what you learn in school, that you can count up to number. That's repetition. That's an echo of other people's memory, isn't it? You learn after all just empty words. And you think, as long as you think that numbers are quantities, you have not entered the problem, what's the relation of numbers to thinking? The relation of sense of numbers to thinking is that 1, 2, 3, 4, 7 are qualities of empirical, you see, living. I can't say more at this moment. I know that you will not agree with me at this moment. It is beyond your own experience, probably. But all I can do is to put this up as a warning. Despise the people, the grown-ups, who poke fun at these mysteries. They say there are no mysteries. But they only say that they are shameless and that they have lost their sense of wonder. The very fact, gentlemen, that Socrates and Plato and Aristotle were needed to fill the world with Greek thought is miraculous. And you can't get out of this fact that one man couldn't do it. That you had to have three generations, and for example, the three generation principle of the life of the Logos, you see, is a tremendous principle. You have it in Christianity. You have John the Baptist, you have the Lord and the Apostles. Without this, there is no revelation possible. Jesus alone can't do it. He has to have somebody who announces him so that people can wait for him and be promised, and he has to have somebody who takes him up on this. And without the apostolic church and the prophesied church, there is absolutely nothing to Jesus. He's just an out of place and out of time. So, believe me, the deeper you study the history of Greek philosophy, the more you must look at the march of these great spirits through time, and you must understand. So far, I have given you this abstract list of 70 or 90 philosophers here. At this moment, however, we are turning towards the center piece of the history of Greek philosophy from Socrates to Aristotle. And the first thing then I want to say is, there had to be three. There had to be three. You couldn't have it cheaper, you see. You couldn't have it in one man. If you understand it, you will understand that there is an element of admiration, of miraculous ethics in the relation of Socrates to Plato, of Plato to Socrates, of Plato to Aristotle, and of Aristotle to Socrates, and of Aristotle to Plato. So when you have three, you have already a very complex relationship, you see, of minds and spirits. And it has still debated. But most people who debate the relations of Aristotle and Plato and Socrates always only figure out what did one say. I am overcome by the miracle of their collaboration, of their mutual influence, you see, that the spirit did flow. That what one man did, the other didn't have to repeat. He could do something else. So Socrates, gentlemen, and Plato and Aristotle represent the first, and you may say also the last, success in Greek philosophy for a division of labor. In this class's famous century, from 399 to 322, you may say, Greek philosophy, and for once had this great
miraculous experience that three independent spirits acted differently and thereby created a unity. Something that after this is always exemplified by these three names. If you speak of Greek philosophy today, you cannot simply say Aristotle, you cannot simply say Socrates, you cannot simply say Plato. Isn't that very strange? I hope that what I'm trying to do is, gentlemen, I've invited you from the beginning to admire these great geniuses. Today I am asking you to admire something that brought three of these geniuses into focus, into mutual dependency, you see, into something that is more than just sequence in time.
You see,
it's a division of labor. And that is very miraculous. And it remains remarkable. And you can ponder for a whole life whenever you read any one of these writings of these three men, you can never forget that the two others faceted and varied and made more meaningful one of these three men saying. They belong to each other. One begets the other, you see. But it is in a way so as though Aristotle and Plato were already contained in Socrates, and as Socrates had to linger on in Plato and Aristotle, you see. And as soon as the Socratic quest died in these Aristotelians of later time, the Platonists of later time, and they just repeated their being Platonists alone, Aristotelians, you see, they remained stars. You have to contain today an element of Socrates, an element of Plato and Aristotle in your side yourself if you want a philosopher. Nobody today can say he is an Aristotelian. Nobody can say he's a Platonist, and nobody can say he's a Socratic. I mean, this is utterly stupid. An element of all three, you see, is necessary to get yourself moving, to get yourself into real life. Let's have a break. The greatest miracle in these philosophers is beyond your reach, the form of their lives. I try to tell you that the Plato's biography certainly is a very miraculous display of a spectrum of colors out of one light. I mean, the consequence of his life, the logic of his life, of his biography is very great. And yet it is constant transformation. He is every 10 years a new man in order to be the same. The motto in my own books, in my own book sign reads, Mutabor tamen manevo. That means I shall be changed, and for this very reason I shall remain the same. Now I think any living person, gentlemen, has this problem. In order to be the same, you have to be different in every age of your life. That's very strange, but that's how it is. You see, in order to be the same, because an element of your sameness is that you are, for example, vital. Now, you can't be vital if you only do 20 years long the same thing. So, in order to remain vital, you have to do after 20 years something different, you see, so that you are still the same man of whom people said he had some vitality left. Isn't that true? Now, most people don't understand this, that in order to remain the same, we have to change. And that is, of course, the greatness of a man like Aristotle or Plato and of Socrates, and I can't ask you to do this. It's beyond, I think, your art and your skill, and you have perhaps to have a dim impression that the greatness of this man is in his fulfillment of this tremendous task to do as much changing as is necessary to save his aliveness, his vitality. For this you have to change. And in Plato's life, it isn't as difficult to grasp as with Aristotle, because we know Aristotle also had a highly dramatic life. To be the teacher of Alexander the Great is not a minor matter, and to go to a foreign court, and to go to Asia Minor, and then return to Athens, and so on and so forth. So you can also dramatize the life of Aristotle. But to see it in connection with his problem of saving the heritage of all the previous Greek thinking from Homer to Socrates, that in his biography, that I think is beyond your ken, and therefore I'm perfectly satisfied if you, I've given you the task, just describe for what Plato stands as the founder of the Academy, and not in what phases of life he produced these results. the second thing, this biographical miracle, I think you should keep in mind that we worship these people as miraculous revelations of human power, of human the human art of living. But I think that has to wait. And I hope you will not give up the Greek philosophy because you have unfortunately taken a course and written a final in it. That's always the end with you with any subject matter that you think never again. Greek philosophy is something to accompany you. You can take any of these dialogues of Plato and read it with the greatest amazement for the 50th time, just like Homer. I read Homer every year and I read a Platonic dialogue every year and I've always totally forgotten that I ever read them before. That does not mean that I haven't read them very attentively and very fruitfully, but there's some, so they have this freshness as a Shakespeare play, or a Bible. You can read this first chapter in the Bible as though you had never read it before. And that's the problem of living, you see. You must meet your wife after the silver wedding as though you had never seen her before. If you can do this, you can say that you really have loved your wife. If you say after 25 years, I know her by heart, you better get a divorce. So there's always still something ahead of you. If you describe Plato's philosophy as expressed, for example, in the Republic, I shall be very satisfied indeed, if you can do it. This is obviously, gentlemen, on your part, only a first attempt, and you treat it as a first attempt. And I hope you don't have to write a second term paper on the same men, but you should know that it is just an attempt to come near these men. And you are not through with them after you have written the paper, obviously. Therefore, it's so hard for me to say from what point you shall approach it. I've given you great leeway. You can pick out two or three symptomatic and outstanding contributions of these men, and you can't misread them totally. Something will stand out. To this I must now turn. Mm-hmm. I'll turn back to Socrates, and then we shall not devote too much time to Socrates himself anymore, and then after the vacation next Tuesday we will settle on reading the fourth book of the Republic here together. Not that this is all you have to do. I hope you will read the rest of the three books preceding it yourself in the process, but I want to give so much time that the strange text comes up word by word here in class. So next Tuesday, please bring the Platonic dialogue. Today I will have to repeat and to brush up on the problem of Socrates. Socrates is a legend. He was a legend in Greece and he is a legend today. That is, there's more talk about Socrates than we possibly can know. That's a legend. We know very little about Socrates. Or you can say we know so much that you haven't the faintest idea what is really fact, you see, and what is imagination. The clue to Socrates, which you must never forget, which is very hard for you to understand, but on which you must build your thought in future years, and I take it that there will be in future years on your part a desire perhaps to understand what it is all about, this getting out beyond the commonplace, is that he asks the questioner. I told you that the problem of Socrates was to turn the process of questioning, you see, so far that he would question those who question. If you do not see this second power, this asking to the square, you will always mistake the curious question of a child, mother, how are the children born, or is there a god, or has God a white beard, for a Socratic question. That's not a Socratic question. That's just a stupid question. In this country, every question is admitted. As long as you cannot cut out and excise stupid questions, gentlemen, there can be no progress, there can be no education, there can be nothing. The best answer to a stupid question remains to this day not to answer it. Nobody seems to have the courage in this country to say that's such a stupid question that I won't answer it. You answer every question, and thereby you always get into deep water. That is all you expect. If you ask a stupid question, that somebody is stupid enough to answer it. Never forget that one fool can ask more questions than 100 wise men can answer. That's the first rule of all thinking processes, gentlemen. Why? I remind you, I told you, questioning means the desire for participation of the ignoramus in a going concern. You ask for the road in a foreign country, you ask for the cost of a ticket at the booth, you see, he knows, you don't know. All questions presuppose an action. You can only ask as long as you think there is somebody who knows. If you drop this qualification of questioning, you see, that it is an attempt of the outsider to get inside society. You cannot understand the limitations of all asking. A question only makes sense if there is a pre-established answer, which this man doesn't know, but which all the others know. That's how we all move in a foreign country. That's how you move in a foreign world of grown-ups. When you enter a new thing, you have to ask. And people are not kind enough, so you're wrong, as you say. And as long as this is the relation of question and answer, everything is safe and so, sane and so, you see. But of course, a child, for example, asks many stupid questions because it just doesn't know where it wants to get into. It is so far away from the ways of the grown-ups, you see, that it asks anything. So the one condition for the question and for the questioner is that he's seriously loving the group which can answer the question. If you are not, if they haven't the real desire to ask for the road to the harbor because you want to go on this road to the harbor, you don't deserve an answer. Can't you see this? The child that asks you see about the white hill of God doesn't deserve an answer because he doesn't intend to pray to God. It shouldn't be blasphemy. Don't answer it. It's a stupid question. The condition of a question is that the questioner wants to join the community. That's a very simple rule, gentlemen, and explains the whole Platonic, Socratic, Aristotelic obsession with the city of men. All questions must remain related to the city of men. Otherwise, they do not deserve an answer. Therefore, Socrates comes in and asks and tries to prove that the questioner has to be asked if he is really serious. Does he really mean business? Does he want to be good, courageous, prudent, a good citizen, you see? Or does he just ask to show off as a sophist to show that he can prove anything, you see, for the sake of argument? There's all of Parmenides is written about this topic, for example, or the Gorgias, you see, or the Protagoras, the Aeon, you see. For the sake of argument, you can argue anything, but you must remain related, as Plato then formulates it in his dialogues, to the good. The good is the sum, so to speak, of serious participation. If you do not remain seriously have not the desire to get inside or to stay inside, whatever the situation is, you see, your question is not a good question. We are full of this nonsense today, gentlemen. This is the era of the sophists. Never have the sophists ruled this country. They call themselves, I don't know what they call themselves, broadcasters or intellectuals or quiz kids or what. $64,000 question. The only good thing about the $64,000 question, obviously, are the $64,000, but not the question. The question is a nonsense question. They are nonsensical questions that are asked on this English Christian thing. The possessed entertainment, so I aren't that excited over this, you see. But obviously, you are much better off if you don't know the answer. It's like these yes and no examinations, gentlemen. I mean, it's not important to know these yes and no's. Any term paper written on the Stoics, it can't be just that bad as these papers that you have to, where you have to guess 50% of right, you see, with yes and no. That's not worth answering. Because it isn't, you are not serious, you don't want to know the good. you won't, by the help of the answering this question, join the community and contribute something to the communal life. You don't want to find a road into the good life. That's very important, gentlemen, because you open a book by Plato or Xenophon on Socrates or the traditions on Socrates. He is parroting up his questions as if like a stupid child at first sight. So don't get annoyed. Make this distinction clear to you, gentlemen, that Socrates, the Socratic method, sifts the questions. You are absolutely lost if you mistake the form of question as being the same between Socrates and a child. But this is today the average error, because everybody in this country thinks that he is a philosopher. And that everybody is as stupid, every philosopher is rated as to be as stupid as the man who reads up on philosophy. But philosophy is a vocation, gentlemen, a very disagreeable vocation, and in the case of Socrates it ended with death, in the case of others it ended with exile, in the case of others it ended with madness, in the case of others it ended with persecution, or with poverty, or illness, because it is the attempt to throw down the usurped questioners, the intellectuals in a community, the sophists, who at that moment, you see, will not be the aesthetes and celebrate poetry for poetry's sake, or artists for art's sake, or politicians for politics' sake. They will not give answer to the question, what's the good of your question? Why do you ask this question? And the Socratic answer is that you must thereby be led to lead a better life. Otherwise, the question cannot be answered because you have no yardstick. The mere juggling of tossing up and tossing down of words makes any answer possible, gentlemen. The difference between the sophist and Socrates is that Socrates wants to be a sophist who tries the sophist. And I think it is not only natural that therefore he should have been crucified. It's a very disagreeable task, a very unpleasant task, and nobody is liked, you see. My friend Samuel Morrison now gave some lectures on the trash and on the hypocrisy and on the insincerity of American education, and he had to go to Canada to deliver these lectures because in America nobody would have listened to his provocation. The sophists are always in command, if not somebody sticks his neck out and risks to ask them, what are you doing with the mind, with the brain, with your logic, with your quizzes? Who is stopping world origin? That's the question. That's a very serious question. Who is stopping these obscenities? Who is stopping the comic strips? Who is stopping the nonsense that's going on in television and whatnot? Who is? The philosopher. If he doesn't exist, if such a healthy force doesn't develop, you see, the country must go out of hand, obviously. And you have then some mental, moral, or financial crisis. You just have to read the behavior of the people in the 20s when they said that all the laws of the universe were successfully abolished, saving was ridiculous, you see, death would yield, people would go become 150 years old, you see. You had to live on the installment plan. Well, the doctrines are nearly as equally men at this moment, but not quite. In the gate 28, you prepared the crash because there was nobody who was listened to. Sinclair Lewis came home from Europe in 28. He went on Fifth Avenue to his publisher's office. He looked down on the street and the publisher said, how do you like it? And he said, I think the world here is insane. Absolutely insane. And Sinclair Lewis, after all, a man of quite superior intelligence. You may have heard of his name. And the publisher, of course, thought that Sinclair Lewis was mad. And he thought that the world, Sinclair Lewis thought that the publisher was insane. Well, a year later, the issue was settled. But the man like Sinclair Lewis was the Socratic element in America, there's no doubt about it.
from Babbitt on, you see, he has acted as a Socratic element, questioning the people, you see, with who put all the silly questions into people's minds. So to speak, the daily philosophers of the moment. Because it was a philosophy in 28, you see, that saving was ridiculous, that tomorrow would be better than yesterday, etc., you see. That death was abolished, sickness was abolished, you see. Children didn't have to obey their parents, you see. Everybody had to sleep with everybody else, constantly. A friend of mine in 28 was in New York when the men in the cocktail party went to him and said, oh, you know, I have a funny feeling my wife's just sleeping with a Negro. He said, what do you say? Well, you see, after all, we are civilized men. I couldn't forbid it. She wanted to have the experience. Well, she had the experience. That's by and large the life of the age of the sophist. You always get this, gentlemen. You always get this tremendous temptation by argument from the outside, outside the polis. If you have this, you see this abstract thinking, you can prove everything to anybody. If you forget the good life, that the generalization, gentlemen, the general thought must create a better city. So now you see perhaps that the Socratic element tries to bind together second impressions, second thoughts, critical thoughts, you see, with the force and authority of primary ethics, of primary truths, of the code of the city, of the worship of the true gods, you see, and make sure that what's going on in this more general room of schools and thinking, you see, of the Eleatics or of the Milesians, you see, all it remains within the fruitful process, so to speak, you see, of landing as again into something concrete and real. Can you see this? This is the service rendered by Socrates. And since the city of Athens, of course, hated the sophist, his being the super sophist, Athens the sophist too, aroused their suspicion. They couldn't understand what he was doing because he did it for the first time. On the other hand, gentlemen, Socrates seems to have fully understood, I say this tentatively because everything we say about Socrates is tentative, he seems to have fully understood that you could not turn the clock back, that Athens as the capital of the Greek, the whole Greek world, had to digest these sophists as they came from Sicily, from Italy, from Asia Minor, you see. And so that he had a certain amount of tolerance. It's a combination then of criticism of these critics, you see, and of tolerance, which seems to have impressed all contemporaries. As the great thing about Socrates is he never wrote a line. He never wrote a line. And therefore, we have no authentic utterance of his own thought. We only have him in the descriptions of others who had their own philosophy, who built on his questions already answers. And therefore, we do not know how much in Plato's dialogue is Socratic and how much is Platonic, you see. Because Socrates has given the question, you see, and Plato then gives the final composite answer, you see. And what I call the division of labor is put it to a high degree in the Platonic dialogue developed there with great skill, that the desire, the zest for questioning all these critical positions of the Eleatic school, of the Pythagorean school, and so is then driving Socrates onto a positive solution which he obviously has never given in his lifetime, but which is the Platonic solution, you see. And I have to perhaps to put one word here at the end before you that is Miss Class, in the Platonic obligation to clear up any misunderstanding about Socrates' intent forces Plato to go one step further, to go beyond the question of the questioner, you see, and to create a utopia. It is very hard for me today, you may be different, but for me to be patient with Plato's utopia. I think his utopias, his polity, and so are terrible. I want to tell you frankly that I couldn't live one day in the Platonic universe, and it's a terrible utopia.
But I can do justice to his necessity of saying that he meant business, that he wanted not to be remain a critic. Therefore, he said, I wish to prove that there is a best city, you see, a better city. And the word utopia is needed for us. Utopia means nowhere. It is not a Greek word, gentlemen. It was invented in the year 1560 by the great British Chancellor Thomas Morris. And it means nowhere. Nowhere. Purpose is a place. In no place. Now, today everybody speaks of Plato's state as a utopia. It is not the word of Plato. His word is the best state, which is quite different, you see. You see, you have Athens. You have the better state of all these critics. Of the critics who question the individual states. And you have then Socrates proving that none of these critics really has a complete picture of the city. Socrates proves, will you take this down? Socrates proves the incompleteness of the responsibility in the critics. He argues some points. We shouldn't have elections every 4 years, we should only have them every 8 years, you see. But the whole of democracy is not in their mind. They don't care for this city, for their survival. They only care for their mini criticism, you see, for their witnesses. You can criticize any little particle of the system, you see, of the whole order. I can criticize that I call my parents parents if I do not understand what the whole family is all about. And people have done this in the last years, as you know. They say, why call father father? You see, call him Charlie. And they have done it because they didn't know what the family was there for. That the family was a representative created in the image of God. Well, you can't call God Charlie, therefore you can't call your father Charlie. If you don't understand, however, that the family is created in the image of God, then you cannot understand why your father cannot be called by his nickname. Chinaman or whatnot. And we have shown this in this country, the sophistry so far, that the families have been destroyed by this. Therefore, Socrates says the critics don't have the city of men at heart. They don't want to return into the community. And Plato says, therefore I have to give them the best state. That's his obsession. Now, there is a relation between the good state, the better state, the better individual items. I shouldn't say state here, that's not right. The better measures, better laws, better customs, and the best state. Plato is the first Greek philosopher who feels obliged, you see, in order to dam up these wanton criticism of single features, to give out of the mind a full-fledged picture, you see, of our destiny. That had never been done before. An unreal city, you see, to be developed out of of philosophy, so that all the witticisms and criticisms could fall into a special pattern, you see, and not be anyone exaggerating. And so Plato is the first utopian. It's a great topic now in Europe to write on utopia. I have several friends who at this time are concerned with producing books of 600 and 700 pages on utopia. And of course the Bolsheviks have a utopia, the classless society, that's a utopia, you see, a nowhere, a best state. But you must understand the Socratic problem is bound up with the final solution of Plato. If Socrates says all these people who know better, you see, know nothing because they don't know the good. So Plato comes in, then we must know the best. Will you kindly try to put down this strange climax, the good, the better, the best. It is, I must invite you, otherwise you will never understand the relation of Platonism, you see, to the good and to the sophists. And never, you will always remain Greenwich Village intellectuals otherwise.